listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggle for love and revolution. Revolution. This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with five amazing guests: Kathy Kelly, Tom Hastings, David Sumas, Gretchen Casey, and Cindy Reinhardt, who are all working in the fields of peace and conflict resolution, from the personal to the international. And take a look at my recently published novel, The Way Between, as a lens for examining the escalating conflicts in our real world. Hello and welcome to all of our listeners of Love and Revolution Radio. I'm your host, Rivera Sun, and we unfortunately don't have Sherry Mitchell with us today, but we know she's here in spirit with us. Today, as the world is spiraling through its cycles of craziness and adventure and a little bit of insanity, and also kind of really calling out the people with good hearts into action, we're going to take a moment on today's show and do something I promised long ago, which is take a full show to discuss my newest novel, The Way Between. Now, this is a book for young adults, but also all the way up through your grandmother could read it and love it. It's the story of a young girl, Ariara, who is chosen to follow a mysterious path between fight and flight called The Way Between, and she's doing this in the midst of a war culture in a fantastical land. And I thought this would be a good week to talk about the role of story and myth and belief around war or peace and nonviolence as we look around our own world and we see more wars and military tensions being aggravated through our administration, but also many of us have noted the enthusiasm that our friends and neighbors seem to have for war. So we're going to actually invite a whole long group of guests onto the show, some ordinary readers, some peace builders, some peace activists and conflict study professors. We're also going to have some veterans for peace. And we're going to use The Way Between as a way to look at our own world and our choices around war and conflict. First up on today's program, we're going to speak with Tom Hastings, who has been on the show before. He is a professor of conflict studies at Portland State University, and he's also the editor of Peace Voice and also an author of many books on nonviolence. Joining him and myself is Kathy Kelly, who is a bit of a legend in her own right, very real, very down to earth, but also the co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and she has been a peace activist who both challenges and confronts the military here in the U.S., but also travels to conflict zones where our military is waging war to meet real people and to wage peace in the midst of the conflict. So Tom and Kathy, welcome to today's show.
Oh, thank you, Rivera. I'm really pleased to be with Tom and you.
Thank you very much, Rivera.
I want to just invite you, Kathy. You had a chance to read this book on your way to Afghanistan, I believe, and to reflect on it. And so you sent me some really wonderful, insightful reflections on your perspective on this novel. It's certainly an adventure story, but also some of the parallels that are applicable to our real world. So I'm just going to invite you and to share your thoughts with some with the listeners today.
The copy I was reading remained in Afghanistan. I was actually tempted to give it to a woman in Jordan who said she'd be fascinated to read it. But I said, well, you'll have to get it yourself because I need to take this with me and pass it on to my young friend Nematullah. I was amazed at the parallels and also the number of times that I found myself thinking, oh, I've got to pass the book on to this person as well. In fact, we have a house guest right now who's waiting for the local bookstore to open up so she can go and get a copy. She's a playwright who has written a play with similar themes. So aware of the war culture we live in, of the way in which we are schooled constantly to believe that militarism and war are the only answers, and this has drawn the United States into war after war after war. So one of the things that was very refreshing about The Way Between was the chance to watch Ariara becoming more persistent in her beliefs, becoming more aggressive in her beliefs, mentored by a war-weary warlord, and then able to draw on a variety of talents and skills that emerged from amongst different people in the book. I really enjoyed reading it. I think it's a fantastic story, just in terms of good fiction. But it certainly reveals a number of different directions to which we can turn, to which we can appeal in hoping to build and strengthen our efforts to overcome the addiction to war. I'm glad to be on the show with Tom, because one thing I thought of is that the role of the archivists, if you will, in the book, it's a bit quiet, but it certainly is there. At one point, Ara and her young friend Minley actually break into the archives, and they find a very important document that will end up helping them to solve the puzzle over how they might woo people or win people over to a belief in the legitimacy of non-military efforts of getting over war. And then the character of Minley is somebody who very much belongs in the world of books. And Tom has certainly, in his role as a professor and as an editor and as someone who has kept very close track of many, many writings by various peace activists, I think has served that kind of a role. And then to see that in the book, Minley, the character who is a bit bookish compared to Ariara, who has such physical prowess, Minley's strengths become crucial, and never does Ariara want to abandon Minley, and he then discovers his own strengths over time, even though he can't follow her in bounding over the hills or in standing on one leg for long lengths of time. Nevertheless, she herself develops her own capacity for stubborn persistence by practicing being a person with only one leg for long periods of time. And I think, in a sense, identifying with Minley and with the way that he has to struggle to move forward in his own development. So I've said a great deal, but I just wanted to tell a few of the things that I found so wonderful in that choreography of characters in the book.
Thank you, Kathy. It is a pretty powerful thing when you have two characters, two young children, both Ariara and Minley, each of whom has had a certain amount of scarring from their war culture. I mean, Minley's is obvious. He has one leg and has lost that leg in the context of war. But then Ariara's scarring is not as obvious. It's beneath the surface of the physical appearance and comes up in her loneliness or her isolation. But it certainly is a theme that recurs, because war, whether we're directly in the middle of it or we're standing on the side of it or our lifestyles are maintained by war, scars us deeply in so many ways. And one of the things that Minley and Ariara discover is how to use their strengths, their differing strengths, to support and affirm the healing and transformation of one another in their weak spots. So I think that's something that is actually very handy for all of us as we're trying to challenge, confront, transform, and heal from the context of our war culture. For young people in a wide variety of situations, books or movies become our space of not just leaving the realm that we know so well, but also traveling to other places and experiencing new experiences. And when we look at the books, when I look back at the books that I read as a young child, Ariara's age, most of those that I really loved involved female heroines going and charging into battle, swinging swords. And I was a bit dismayed to grow up and realize that that wasn't actually a very functional metaphor to have learned. And that was one of the intentions with the story of The Way Between, is what if we could have all that adventure, have all that stepping into another realm, have the challenge and the excitement, but with skills that actually help us when we grow up to navigate conflict, to transform conflict, to prepare us for a global society of 7.2 billion people in a land of shrinking resources and major challenges like climate change, that we need these skills. And I think this might be a good time to turn it over to Tom, because Tom, as a conflict studies professor, you stand at that intersection every year, meeting young students who come from the background of the general United States and actually giving them another way, perhaps a way between or an entry point into peace building and conflict resolution. And I'm be curious to hear your thoughts.
Well, I really appreciate both of your thoughts, Rivera and Kathy. While Kathy was talking, I was thinking about your story, very masterfully spun, Rivera, and the Afghan youth that Kathy has worked with, and how they seem almost as magical in their way as does this story. And that's the art of the best fiction, is to come so close to reality that we are able to suspend our disbelief and we can follow you through the story. And that's exactly what you do with this novel. I think it's very important. I routinely, and I hope Kathy comments on some of the youth, because her writings that she sends to me and that I get a chance to read directly from her about these children in the middle of a shooting conflict, a bombing conflict, a droning conflict, who come up with the resilience and the just the cheerfulness and the sort of joie de vivre, the joy of life that they bring into an area you would think would be absolutely desolate. So that to me helps us to say, well, this novel, this work of so-called fiction, may contain some shards of magic, but it also contains a whole dollop of reality. And the reality may come from a culture we know, or it may come from another culture. One of my students, who is a young Lakota Sioux woman, posted in our discussion board just yesterday about the ubiquity of violence in so many cultures. And another student said, yes, it's like the air we breathe. We don't even notice the violence all around us because it is so pervasive. We're saturated in it to the point where we hardly see it. So along comes a Kathy Kelly or a Rivera Sun with her stories that break out of that saturation. And I think this is absolutely crucial, because we can't see it unless somebody else says, wait a second, there's a different perspective. Look at this. There's not just a third way, there's a fourth, fifth, and sixth way. There are infinite ways, because that's the one thing we have in our human capacity, is our illimitable imagination.
I completely agree with you about that, Tom. And once you know a little bit about nonviolence and waging peace, it is a little frustrating, actually, to watch, let's say, movies where the conflict is always resolved by, in some degree, somebody using violence. And the idea that, you know, you pick up the gun, you wage the battle, and then you get the girl and ride off into the sunset. And it's actually pretty boring when you understand the other options that are out there in the world. And then it's also very tragic, because when people don't know their options, they tend to replay that big myth over and over again. And we see it all over the place, but we especially see it in our foreign policy in the United States. We just saw it with President Trump's use of retaliatory violence over the chemical attack from allegedly Assad in Syria, you know, as if bombing more was actually going to resolve that situation in a positive way. But Kathy, I'm curious, you know, Tom mentioned some of your work with young people around the world, and how do they find these creative solutions, especially in places where they've seen so much war and so much violence? And, you know, one would suspect that there could be almost a despair of violence is the only thing that's getting anywhere. But instead, what I found over and over again is many people seeing that violence is really not working out for them. It's not working out for us, but it's certainly not working out on the ground. And the search for a different way. Would you speak a little bit about that?
Well, you know, there was a terrible attack on a military base in Afghanistan where many of the recruits were young, impoverished people. Why did they become recruits? The military itself in Afghanistan will acknowledge that they simply had no other way of getting an income. And so amongst the young people I know, there's great, great regret any time one of their brothers or uncles or friends joins the military. And they tell me over and over again, it's only because they don't have another way to earn money. It kind of reminds me of the very resigned monks in your story who don't really want war but can't see another way. Well, people who are desperate to eat sometimes can't see another way other than joining some militia or some armed grouping. Sometimes it's the Afghan government's armed groups. And it's remarkable to me how many of my young friends have lost their relatives, their brothers, fathers, uncles, friends, because of being involved in the military. So I'm pretty convinced that my young friends' tie impoverishment, severe poverty, to fighting and killing. And what they've concocted, and it is kind of magical, is a way of reaching out to the poorest people and extending as best they can whatever resources they can pull together to try to help alleviate that poverty. And I've seen it work. I mean, I know a youngster in particular who disappeared for a while, and we wondered what happened. He was a street child. He had no income, and sure enough, we found out that he had experimented with joining an armed group, and then he decided to run away from them and came back. And the way that he can survive with his family is through being part of the street kids' school, and as the youngsters go to this school and get tutoring to prepare them to go to regular school, they also get a monthly ration of cooking oil and rice and sometimes beans that the Afghan peace volunteers provide through the generosity, really, of people in the United States. But anyway, what I see is that when people kind of take out of the toolkit weapons and killing and murder and bloodshed, then other possibilities become more emphasized. It's something like young Min Lee not having in his toolkit, if you will, the possibility of competing in the games and becoming somebody with an athletic prowess he could dedicate toward killing. Well, that wasn't going to happen for him. So other skills of his came to the fore and became so very, very important.
It reminds me, as you're speaking, that the great irony is that a lot of people join the military in the United States for the same sort of economic pressures that we have, what we call the poverty draft, that people are being drafted not through, you know, the pulling of their number, but rather through the fact that they don't see any other options as well. And so I think maybe there's a lesson in there that could be deeply shared across these warring nations about how can we meet the needs of our populace so that our young people don't have to go into the military. I mean, there's so many layers to the tragedy that is war, and that's just one more of them. Also, in the way between, that certainly is the dynamic, the economic pressures that underlie all war cultures that need to be named and articulated, and the greed also in the empowered elite that foments the cycles of war. That's something that certainly showed up in The Way Between and is going to play a bigger role in the sequel coming up, which I'll be writing over the summer. Because we need to know that. We need to really get over the idea that we're going to war to defend noble principles. That certainly is true for some people, but later on in the show today, we'll be having some Veterans for Peace members come on, and one of their things that they often articulate is that they signed up for principles and they found out that that wasn't why the war was being fought. The war was being fought for profits. And the great betrayal of trust that happens in a human being's heart when that is understood is a very, very profound thing.
Another aspect of Tom's work that we might draw attention to is that he's been part of the Catholic worker movement. And in these Catholic worker houses of hospitality all across the United States, often a hand is extended to people who are veterans of wars. And from recent wars, from the Iraq War, from the war in Afghanistan. And, you know, that people come back so very, very scarred and sometimes are not able to live normally in society any longer and sometimes feel such desperation that they're among the 22 combat veterans on average every day who take their lives, who kill themselves. So the tragedy of war not being over when it's so-called over is something else that, comes through in your book because of the generations that have gone on and on with this myth that they don't have any other choice but to go to war with each other. Of course, if we're ever going to find the resources to solve the real threats we face, the global warming and climate change, we're going to have to take those resources away from the military because the military gobbles up, inhales like a big demonic suction cup, Martin Luther King said, our resources and our abilities to solve problems.
So I would like to touch on three sources of the power of fiction that I think are something that you achieved with this work, Rivera. One is Hemingway. At one point, Hemingway wrote that any writer had better know enough to write about 10 times longer than she or he does. The knowledge that you possess does not have to all go into your writing, but the reader will be able to tell if the writer is skilled enough. And that's exactly what you've done with this story. The I happen to know from your attendance at the Lawson Institute and from many opinion pieces that I've been able to distribute of yours, that you have a deep theoretical knowledge of nonviolence and also in the appendices of this book. But you weave it in so artfully that the reader doesn't object. The reader doesn't feel lectured to. This is a real story, and you pull us through this story and achieve these goals really, really well. The second point that I want to compare it to is my favorite movie of all time, Whale Rider. And you achieved, to me, the same thing in a novel that Whale Rider achieved as a movie, which was to say you can honor, first of all, the hero is a young girl, and she achieves this amazing balance of honoring the traditional and evolving the traditional, because oftentimes the traditional wisdom and methods are frozen in place when they are crushed by the colonial violence. They're frozen in place because they're defeated, and yet they're desperately trying to hold on to the core of their identity. So it's impossible for them to evolve. And she breaks through that, just as your heroine does in The Way Between. Finally, I want to talk about, just for a second, about Gandhi and what he did with the Bhagavad Gita and the great stories of violence. And what he claimed, and he convinced a lot of people, nobody in several thousand years successfully reinterpreted the Bhagavad Gita to the acceptance of so many people, as did Gandhi when he said, no, all of the violence done by the warrior Arjuna was metaphorical. I thought that was just, that's an amazing achievement, and you've done exactly that in this book. This book, and I'm happy to share my review with anybody who wants to ask me for it, but it's something that I feel should be required reading. As soon as somebody's able to read and reaches the age of reason, whatever that may be for some people, from that on, like you said, to the grandmothers, to the great-grandmothers, and the great-grandfathers, this is an important book.
Well, thank you, Tom. I really appreciate that shining endorsement. And I do think that one of the things that I try to do in all my novels, but this one particularly does, is take back, in a very old, like long millenniums, long journey of human evolution, take back the values that we love that are very human, but have been paired to violence and warfare. And my personal take is that, you know, the values of courage, of loyalty, of strength and stamina, of love and passion, all of those were actually, they predate the use of war and violence. And they were co-opted by the rise of conquest maybe 4,000 years ago, 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, as it became more prevalent throughout the early world. And so we've learned to love them in the context of war and violence, but we're turning again in the long arc and cycle of humanity, and it's time for those of us who work in culture, in arts, in music, and writing, to really stand on the firm ground of these values and understand that they can be applied as well to nonviolent action, to waging peace. There's nothing more courageous to me than the work that Kathy actually does in waging peace. And, you know, it's Kathy, you're about as far from the stereotypical image of the raging soldier going into battle as anyone can imagine, but the courage that you display day after day is extraordinary, completely extraordinary. And so you, Kathy, and you, Tom, are the living embodiments of the heroes, the change, the transformation that's happening in the world that I feel just very honored to get to write about in fiction for new generations, that we have this lineage of nonviolence and waging peace that have given us the real-life examples that we can hang our hats on and believe in. And so that gives me the confidence to write a novel that you can give to a child and say, read this. You're going to love the story, and you're going to get to grow up into the story. We can do that because of the work that you and you, Tom, and Kathy have done in the world to really demonstrate the power of these alternate means of dealing with conflict. Well, you two, we could talk for hours, and we probably should, but I just want to give you each a last brief minute to share a last reflection before we give the microphone over to a couple more guests who have also wanted to join us to talk about this book.
Well, it's actually a book that I'm looking forward to rereading. I think Ari Ara certainly can be a captivating character and gives encouragement for the long haul. So I'm very, very grateful to you, Rivera, for creating the character and promising us a sequel. And it's been just a delight to be thinking with both you and Tom about the book, and I'll certainly look forward to reading Tom's review, and I'll hope to write one myself soon.
Great. We'll put it in our show notes as well for all of you listeners out there.
Yeah, what I want to see is the next phase of this is a Hollywood blockbuster based on this. And the next phase after that is the action figures that all children should have based on these characters. And then I want to see other action figures. Like, I want to see Kathy Kelly action figure with a cape because she flies around the world so much. At one point, when she was breaking sanctions on Iraq that were killing children, Kathy was bringing medical supplies into Iraq and was basically getting arrested by everybody on all sides of everything. And I talked to her when I was teaching at Northland College. She would come up once in a while, and I'm on the phone with her from my little office in the college, and I'm saying, Kathy, how are you doing? And she said, I feel like I've been on a bungee cord to Baghdad. So this is Kathy Kelly for more than a generation. She's been literally heading into the hottest hot spots. Where was she during shock and awe in Baghdad? What was happening when things were heating up in Swat Valley? There was Kathy Kelly. So to me, she's an action figure, and we need to start making this part of our culture, and you've done that really, really well, Rivera.
Thank you, Tom. Well, on my little action figure bookshelf, I want Tom Hastings and Kathy Kelly and a few more notables that, you know, maybe Gandhi. There is a Gandhi out there, so we can all start collecting.
Tom and I will probably be trying on capes as soon as we get off the line.
Well, thank
Gandhi
you.
Man, Buddha boy. Thanks, Rivera. Thanks, Tom.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID. Next up on Love and Revolution Radio, as we speak about The Way Between, is going to be a gentleman named David Sumis, who is a Veterans for Peace. He lives in Wisconsin, And David and Lars Pripp go down to the Madison State Capitol every week and demonstrate for peace. They've been doing this for a number of years, and they've used a variety of tactics in speaking about peace. David, welcome to the show, and thank you for taking the time to discuss this book. So I'm wondering if we can start off our conversation with actually a fairly personal question, and you could say no to this, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what it was like for you as a veteran to read a novel that is set in a war culture and has warriors training for war, young people believing in war, but then also the main hero, the main warrior character in the story, Xu Len, having some really deep second thoughts about this culture that he's a part of. And of course, the young girl, Ariara, has her own take on the war culture. But I'm curious what that was like for you with your own personal journey through some of these thoughts that I imagine might have touched on similar themes.
Yeah, hi, Rivera. I first want to thank you for having me on your program. I think it's a great opportunity for us. Well, as far as the book and how it all set up, as I was reading it, I know I was like, wow, it sure is the United States of America. I mean, that struck me right away, because we do live in a militarized culture. There is no question about it. And I was in the military for 14 years total, which is a pretty long time, and you get kind of immersed in the philosophy of what's happening. And as I know, I've grown over the years, you know, into a much more peaceful person than I ever was as a younger man. Even though I was always kind of peaceful, I've never believed in killing or death penalty or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, I had some experiences early on in my life that forbade me from ever killing. And, you know, someday we can maybe discuss that. But, you know, the book, yeah, I mean, it reminded me so much of our current society here in the United States. And the work that we're doing, we get in contact with a lot of people, veterans, a lot of young people that are planning on going into the military. Lars and I have been able to get into a couple schools, and we did a presentation at a fairly large Catholic high school, junior and senior students. There are, I don't know, 150 to 200 kids in that class. They're very, even in that school, they were very militaristic minded. Militarism plays a big part in our entire society. So the book, The Way Between, it's such a, it's almost like the opposite of what, you know, what is happening in our society. So to be able to read that and understand where it's coming from, I think, was pretty important. And to see the alternative. How do you say the Xu Len? Is that how you pronounce him?
Xu Len.
Xu Len, yeah. You could see his transformation. And one of the things that I've learned over time, talking to a lot of people and talking to folks like yourself, who have a lot of love in their heart and generosity, what is interesting is that I believe humanity, humans in general, have that inside of themselves. But when you live in a militaristic society such as the United States, a lot of that is tuned out over time through our training and propaganda and brainwashing. So, you know, everything that we're about is kind of violent. You know, we solve our issues through violence, whether it be arguing, verbal and or physical violence. So in the book, to see how that transformation how that came about was extremely interesting. And it, I think, relates, you know, the fact that Xu Len was a warrior relates to the veterans in general that are, for the most part, basically warriors. Even those that don't carry weapons are there for one purpose, and that's for what they call defense. But, you know, it is war. I mean, that's what you end up in, and or you're being used as a pawn to exhibit power throughout the planet, actually, especially the U.S. Navy with all their ships and guns and boats with airplanes and fighter jets. So the book, I don't know, I think it's another one that needs to be read, I think, especially by younger folks. get an idea that there's a different way of approaching life and conflict.
One of the things in the book that Ariara encounters is when she brings the idea of the way between this, I guess we could say, non-martial philosophy and way of resolving both the threat of physical danger and the conflicts that arise in her world. When she brings that to public attention, at first it's met with a lot of scorn, a lot of disbelief, like that the way between couldn't actually help them address the looming threat of war that was in front of them. And I'm wondering if you've seen a parallel to that as you go out every Saturday speaking to people about war and peace on the streets of Madison, and just what some of your experiences have been on the ground around speaking up for peace.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that happened with us is the fact that our stance has changed somewhat while we're down there. Like, when we first started going down, you know, our signs and everything were more in your face. The approach was, here's what our country is doing, you know, with our military. And it was kind of forcing the issue, trying to point out what our military is doing, like in the Middle East, for instance, and the fact that it isn't a defensive posture. It's preemptive warfare, and mainly, and I guess I shouldn't even say mainly, it is for resources and control, power control. When we first started doing it in that direction, it created a lot of anger. So, you know, we had a lot of negative feedback, negative pushback. We had people that actually wanted to physically confront us. And over time, I think it was a learning experience, but we softened our approach. And as we've been doing that, it seemed to awaken a lot of people to what we were trying to say. So, for instance, I have a sign, we need more love, not more weapons, okay? And sort of things like that. And it brings a different vibe to the whole thing. So then what happens is that as people respond positively to us, other people see that, and it's like a big feedback loop. So pretty soon you have people coming by handing us flowers and smiling and flipping the peace sign instead of the middle finger. So it brings out the love that's actually within people's hearts that they're suppressing. I think a lot of people with the culture the way it is, and the same thing happened in the book, is that they're so used to the militarism and they're afraid of expressing a peaceful resolution because everything is done different, that people hold back. They don't want to go against the overall culture that they've learned and that they're basically forced into. So, in general, people are starting to understand anyway what is going on. I think there's more and more talk of it. And, you know, it just takes time. I mean, it's a learning experience. But as more and more people start expressing love to one another and caring about one another and sharing with one another, it's sort of a logarithmic effect. It just kind of grows. So the same thing happened within the book. And I don't think the book is quite... We got to wait for volume 2 for the next part, right? But the seed was planted.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good that you bring up volume 2 because it is a series. And I was going to ask you a question that related to the sequel. So I'll be writing it towards the end of the summer and into the fall. And my question for you, from your direct experience speaking up for peace, is when Ariar, no spoilers to the listeners, but Ariar does have an adventure which involves going down to the Capitol and meeting all kinds of people who have all kinds of perspectives on war and peace. And like you guys, is going right down into the Capitol to bring up these issues. Who do you think is going to be her toughest sell on the idea that we have better tools for dealing with our conflicts? What might be the group that's presented you guys with the most challenges, or that might be a parallel that I should put into the story?
I think it's other veterans, actually. For the most part, what I see with veterans is that they are still in that military mode. I mean, that's what they were trained to be, and it's extremely difficult with veterans. So, you know, relating to the book, it would be the warrior class, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular book, I don't know if you want to, somebody that hasn't read it, but there were changes that came about at the end with different groups of people, but I think overall getting the warrior class to change their attitude would be the hardest sell, really, because that's who they are, and that's their life. Here in the United States, the military is huge. I mean, it's been cut manpower-wise, but the overall philosophy is extremely strong. So to get people to look at things in a nonviolent way when you're trained all your entire life pretty much to work things out through dropping bombs and firing missiles, it's a pretty tough cookie to crack, I think. But I think they would be the ones. Although, if you look at the overall, like here in the United States, if you want to make a parallel, our whole culture is like that. I mean, it's embedded extremely deeply into our whole society. So to get people to finally accept the fact that they can actually love one another without having to be violent, just that alone is a pretty big chore. But
well, that will give me a lot of food for thought. It wasn't actually the answer I expected, and so now I'm really going to ruminate on that, and I'll be calling you back to ask, what was it that made you change? As I mean, you and Lars each made a choice to go a different direction, so maybe if we can find the seed of that, unless you have ideas right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think what, like in my case, I can't say for sure with Lars, but I know in my case, I had a circumstance in Vietnam that actually made me think, and I didn't think about it maybe all that much at that exact moment, but later in my life, one thing I've done in my life is I've looked pretty deeply into myself to find out who I am and what's going on and what, you know, in the real world, what is really important. And I realized it wasn't the fact that I had to make money or anything like that. It's really, what's really important is to be able to love one another and to help each other out and to share yourself with other people and do stuff like that, right? And so when I was in Vietnam, I was in an area that was under extremely high combat, and there was B-52 bombings going on all around us, a lot of death, and quite frankly, most Americans that were there didn't treat the Vietnamese people all that well. I mean, there was a lot of animosity against them, and they were victims as much as anybody to the whole warfare culture. But I had at one time four, you know, they were called mamasans, older women that were actually maids for us that got paid very little. But one day I was walking by and they were having lunch, and they invited me to sit down and have lunch with them, and they were cooking over a little Sterno stove in this old beat-up old pot, a bunch of leaves, and I don't know what all was in that little pan, but quite frankly, it didn't look like I wanted to eat it all that much, but that's what they were eating. So they invited me to sit and eat with them, which I did do, and I suffered some consequences later on from some of the guys for even speaking to the Vietnamese, let alone sitting down and eating with them. But that moment stuck with me, and I was like, one day it just, you know, I don't know, it was like one of them epiphany things, you know, it just kind of hit me in my mind, and I was like, and my heart, I was like, wow, I mean, how can somebody, and you know, and sitting down and breaking bread with somebody is an important thing, so how could somebody suffering what they have suffered and what they had seen throughout their lives and as many people that they knew and their relatives that had gotten killed or injured seriously would be able to sit down with who's basically their enemy to a certain extent and to invite them to have dinner, right? It was one of the most powerful moments in my life. So I think that was the seed. And since then, I've kind of developed that over time. So it definitely changed how I feel about everything.
Thank you so much for sharing that story, David. It is a very powerful one and also a really interesting kind of example of the long-term effects of our actions when we choose to wage peace. Like, we don't always see the flowering of the seed. In your case, the flowering of the seed those women planted happened thousands of miles away and many years later, and yet all of us who know you are beneficiaries of getting to be around the flower that you've become. And just, it's an incredible story, an incredible true story about the effect of actions over time when the seed is planted right. We are coming down into the end of our time, but I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to add about the book or about your own experiences with this work, just before we have to say goodbye.
Yeah, I think the main thing, the book is right on, and I loved it a lot. It was nice reading, as all your work is. And I think what's important is that as humans, we start looking at one another as humans, as people, as brothers and sisters, and the common bond we have through our humanity. I think it would go a long way to creating a peaceful world for all of us.
Great. Thank you so much, David. Next guests on the show are a pair of amazing women who live at opposite ends of the country. One is Gretchen Casey, who is newly the Director of Training and Outreach at the River Phoenix Center for Peacebuilding, which some of you listeners know that I just did a week-long Peacebuilders immersion along with Gretchen. She has been a victim advocate with the State Attorney's Office and the Attorney General's Office for 32 years, and so she's steeped and immersed in this work of peaceful change and conflict resolution, but also knows the other side of the shoe, what happens when we don't apply the skills that we've been talking about on the show thus far and exploring in the way between. So we'll be getting her thoughts and insights on the book. Joining us as well is Cindy Reinhardt, who has the amazing background of being one of my first and long-term beta readers on the books, which means she not only reads the books when they have typos in them, she reads them when they really need some revision work too. So her thoughts and reflections mean a lot to me in the process of creating the book. When she's not helping me on that, she works in coaching with people and hosts a B&B in Crestone, Colorado, which offers multi-day retreats for helping people harmonize their lives with themselves and with others and with the planet. So Gretchen and Cindy, thank you so much for joining us on this show.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting us.
Indeed. Thank you.
Wonderful. So Gretchen, let's start with you. I'd love to hear just some of your general thoughts and impressions from your reading of The Way Between.
Oh, I'm so glad you started off with that question, because that's a big, easy one for me, and it makes a huge smile come to my face. I'm someone who really, really enjoys good stories, who really enjoys a plot and something where people go through something and they come out on the other side. And what I like so much about this story and the characters and the themes that run through it are that not only does it expose people who are parents who might be reading this book to a young adolescent reader, but it exposes young people to really look at their values and what's going on below the surface. And these characters do a really, really beautiful job of, they appear to be this, and if you are really listening and paying attention, the author, that would be you, has done just a really fabulous job of peeking into what's going on below the surface for people. And it's not only the story of the lost heir, but it's also what's sort of the microaggressions and the micro things that are taking place in each of these characters' lives. And when that happens for readers, I think it pulls you along and you want to stay on this ride for a while, because it's not just looking at ineffective, say, communication, but it's also really, really pointing out, what does gentleness look like? What does standing up for your values look like? What does tenderness and compassion look like, without being preachy and saying, then this character showed what compassion looked like. So weaving it into a story and also being an extraordinarily good storyteller are things that I think appeal to all ages when they pick up a book.
Thank you, Gretchen. That's always kind of the feedback a writer wants to hear, especially around the preachiness when you're dealing with social justice themes or the themes of war and peace and conflict resolution. And that is something Tom mentioned earlier on the show as, you know, being really important when you're writing on this work. And it's not always easy to do, which Cindy might have caught in some of my earlier writings as she read them, is that shift that occurs when you have to pause and reflect as a writer, because we all have so much to say, but the trick is not just saying what needs to be said, but saying it in a way that can reach the person who's trying to listen for that message. Cindy, how about you, and what are some of your thoughts and reflections?
Well, I could just put a big ditto on just about everything that Gretchen said. What I loved about this book
is that it grabbed me, and I'm not a young adult anymore. It grabbed me. It made me hopeful. It reinforced my hope. I, too, love a good story, and it's just a fabulous, exciting story. So much of what's written today that's exciting is just violent and just win-lose and just, not to be cliche-ish, but old paradigm stuff. And what I loved about this is it isn't. It incorporates those because those are a part of our life experience, but it shows us a different way.
Yeah, I have to say I was really captivated by that not only the way it's framed, but what it's called. And, of course, just intrigued by a character whose name is at least loosely defined or explained as not this, not that. And I think for so many young people, they defy labels and they don't want to do something just because someone tells them to. And so I love that it captures that individualized streak of being very spirited, but also very independent and wanting to choose your own way. And I also think that one of the things that the book does really well is it addresses this sort of in a roundabout way, this notion of good versus evil. She's got this very complicated relationship with this very complicated man, Shulin. And there are times when he has obviously been ravaged and devastated by something. We don't know quite yet what, although there are several hints that are being dropped along the way. And I think what it also does is it helps young readers, as well as having a discussion point if someone's reading the book to a young person, is what does it really mean to be evil? Or what does it mean to be a good person who is scarred or devastated by things that have happened in their past? And how looking at these characters teaches you that we are the sum of so many of our experiences that continue to impact how we look to other people and how we act towards other people and what we try to prevent other people from really knowing about us. So we do some things in hiding or in secret when we think no one's looking. And I think that that's the kind of thing that makes a really enjoyable story.
Well, I think that's something that it rings true for us, and we see it in our own lives and ourselves and other people that we've interacted with. We are getting into our last couple of minutes together, and I want to give you each a chance to just add any thoughts that we haven't gotten to cover yet in our short time together talking about The Way Between. And Gretchen, I'll just invite you to chime in.
Well, I think that storytelling is such a incredibly necessary and important way that we make sense out of what happens in our lives. And so whether they are fables or whether they are sort of fantasy stories are really important means by which we can resolve our own issues in our lives. And sometimes it can take on almost a fantasy kind of feel. And what I think that The Way Between offers is a really cool chance, you know, for young people and maybe the adults or the guardians in their lives, or even for young people to really begin to talk about what grabs you and jumps out at you in this story. Because I could see easily a group of half a dozen or a dozen kids, whether they have any victimization or trauma in their lifetimes or not, or whether they're introverts or extroverts, or whether their cultural history is very different from the child sitting next to them, is that this would be a fantastic read for an entire grade, say sixth graders or eighth graders or whatever, and that the ability to do a book report about something that feels really vibrant and alive would make, I think, reading and social skills and emotional learning really come alive. So I like that this book works on so many levels. It works in the school system. It works for summertime leisure. It works for the introvert. It works for the kid who is, or the child or the young person who has had models in their life that are very, very assertive or even aggressive. Because I think it speaks to so many different ways in which people resolve conflict in their lives and what they turn to. And so when stories like that are offered to young people and parents alike, then I think what happens is the stories really become alive. I can't wait for the next sequel, the next part of this trilogy. So thank you for writing this book. I think you've done a really, really, really beautiful thing that you're putting these books in front of people who will simply enjoy the story. So thank you.
Thank you, Gretchen. I appreciate hearing all of that and just your vision for where and how and who could be reading it. Cindy, any last thoughts from you?
Well, I can just ditto Gretchen again. I too, and I felt this way when I read the draft that I read before publication. I can't wait for the next one. Would you hurry up and finish this one? For me, it rings of harmony and the many faces of harmony and the challenges that we go through both internally and in our relationships with others in trying to move to harmony. And that, it seems to me, is like always the, you know, always the focus and the goal. And I just appreciate that in addition to many of the things that Gretchen has already articulated so beautifully. So I will end with that. It's a manual for harmony and a great story to boot.
Well, thank you both for those words of reflection and really thinking about it in terms of the work that you do and your perspectives on the world. One of the goals with this particular show at this particular time was to really get to look at a piece of fiction in the ways that it relates in our world. And while Tom Hastings and Kathy Kelly spent some time talking about large global conflict, it's been very nice to hear from you, Gretchen, about the work with youth and how this might help them with the small wars, the small conflicts that go on, but loom very large in our own personal experiences on the ground. And also, Cindy, from you with your perspective on the long-term work that we are all doing as adult human beings to find and rebalance our way towards harmony, towards living in peace with one another, and especially with ourselves. So I really appreciate that we got to broaden the dimensions of the show and actually got a chance to like build peace up from the individual through the interpersonal, through our towns and communities. And it's a stepping stone between, you know, finding that inner peace and then waging peace on the massive level that Kathy Kelly and Tom are working on. So thank you guys for joining us on the show today and connecting those dots.
Thank you. I need you to be love, 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 love.
Thanks this week to our guests, Kathy Kelly, Tom Hastings, David Sumas, Gretchen Casey, and Cindy Reinhardt. Links to their work, writings, and organizations can be found in our show notes, in our weekly email, and on our Podomatic page. Our theme song is Love and Revolution by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org. If you're looking to share our podcast, the link to that can be found on Podomatic, iTunes, and Stitcher. And if you'd like to get on our email list, please visit the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, which is also where you can find a copy of The Way Between. This week, listeners, we've explored the topics of war and peace, culture and literature, myth and story with our many guests. But in the end, the plot line of this grand adventure called life all depends on you. So maybe you'll read the book, live the story, and find one more way to follow the way between by the time we talk to you next week. What if you knew that your actions determine the outcome of everything? Your actions determine the outcome of everything.